You are listening to the Lazy Equity Podcast, brought to you by Bobby Hayeri and Darren Venter, founders of the Investors Agency and DEBA. With over 20 years' experience in real estate between them and having bought hundreds, if not thousands, of properties around the country, you are in the right place to learn all things property. This podcast is designed to educate and empower everyday Aussies to take control of their future through property.
Hey guys, and welcome to the latest episode of the Lazy Equity Podcast. And on this episode, I'm really excited to introduce you to Josh McCann. So Josh has recently joined the Investors Agency. And on this episode, we run you through his personal experience, professional experience, not just in property, but also just in day-to-day life. We talk about routines and how important they are as you get older and older, and how it is a great way to manage stress and different life experiences. And we also talk about different types of societies, whether capitalist societies are best or socialist societies, and what the pros and cons of some of them are, along with his thoughts on this. So I'm really excited to share this podcast with you, and thanks a lot for tuning in. Josh, thanks for coming on the show, mate.
Thanks for having me.
Is this your first podcast?
Very first podcast.
How are you feeling?
Feeling excited, as you've told me.
So we were just talking about before the podcast, I was saying how whenever I'm public speaking, I shit myself, I get quite nervous, but I was saying how the chemical that gets released in your brain when you're nervous is the same chemical that gets released when you're excited. It's just how you perceive it.
Just have to flip it.
Yeah, so flip it.
Rewire
yourself,
it.
Exactly. Tell yourself you're excited. I'll be nice. I'll try to be as nice as I can, and we'll just have a casual chat and go from there.
That's okay. You can question me. You can grill me.
you're very well spoken. You're quite composed. You'll be fine on the podcast, mate.
I hope so. See how we go.
See how we go, mate.
Been waiting to see how long it was going to take to get me on here. I started listening to it when you first arranged the interview. Saw that you guys had the Spotify. I'm like, I better start listening.
Yeah, okay. Any feedback for me?
No, I think I've listened to a lot of podcasts over the years, and I think it's very well done.
Sweet.
It seems like you guys have been doing it for years and years and years. When I listen to it,
thank
which
you,
is
mate.
Great.
Thank you, mate. So, bonuses are coming up. Good timing.
Yeah.
mate, tell the listeners who's Josh in a couple of minutes. Let's go personally first.
Personally?
Yeah.
Oh, geez, Josh. Josh is a 25-year-old Northern Beaches resident, aspiring property investor, and buyer's agent now.
Nice. Nice.
That's kind of me. Grew up on the Northern Beaches.
Yeah.
Always been around property. Obviously, there's a lot of beautiful homes around here, and it's something from a young age, I should say.
Yeah.
That I've always wanted to get into. So it's a big part of my life, always has been.
Yeah.
For me personally, big into camping, snowboarding, like just getting outdoors, hitting the beach when I can. Just a Northern Beaches kid through and through.
Nice.
I think.
Mate, with snowboarding, how difficult is it? I've done skiing before, and I've picked it up relatively quickly. It was pretty. I found it quite easy.
Yeah.
Never done snowboarding. Everyone tells me that snowboarding is quite different, and learning is quite a pain in the ass. What's your experience been like with snowboarding?
There is definitely a steep learning curve. I started when I was relatively young. I know most people get into
it. How young is relatively young?
12.
Okay.
So not actually that young in the grand scheme of things. I think if you're in one of those skiing families, you're there from the age of 4 or 5.
Yeah.
So not extremely young, but yeah, there's definitely a steep learning curve. Obviously skiing, you're on two skis.
Yeah.
So you can stand up straight. It's very hard to fall off balance.
Yep.
You can always rely on the old pizza.
Yeah.
but snowboarding, you're going down the mountain sideways. You've got to lean back, but you've also got to lean into your toes as well.
Yeah.
So it can be a bit daunting for some people.
Similar to, I've seen you fanging it down the Corso and along the beach in your electric skateboard.
With the backwards hat.
With the backwards hat. Would you say it's similar to skateboarding?
Yeah, it's similar to skateboarding, depending on how you do it. I think the main thing people struggle with is leaning into the toe side.
Yeah.
Because when you're leaning into the toe side, you're leaning into the mountain. So you're kind of like almost face planting.
Okay.
Whereas most people find it easier to lean backwards because they can kind of fall on their bum onto the snow.
Yep.
So I think when you're starting out later in life, it's a little bit difficult to get your head around. Yeah. But you'll get there. I think we should do an office snow trip.
An office snow trip. Do you reckon it'll be James that's the best again?
No, not with this one.
I wasn't going to mention him on this podcast, but he's already come in, up. He's already in.
Far out.
So for you guys if you guys listen often, you're probably familiar with James. We weren't going to mention him because he's got quite a big ego in the office, but he's come up already, which is unfortunate. And you've been in a very long-term relationship at a young age, right?
Yeah, fairly young. Clarissa and I, we got together when we were 16, 17.
Yeah.
25 now. So,
wow.
We're coming up on 7 years officially.
Okay.
Obviously, we've been together a little bit longer than that, and we knew each other from year 9 high school. So, we've known each other since we're maybe 14, 15.
Nice, mate. That's very similar to D and I.
Yeah.
So, D and I got together when we were 15, 16. Almost 20 years later.
Wow. 20 years.
Crazy, eh?
Flies by, eh?
And who are you professionally?
Who am I professionally?
Not just now, but I guess historically as well. Where have you come from? What's your experience been like on the professional side?
So I got into real estate kind of out of high school. I worked a couple of other jobs casually while I was doing my real estate course, getting my certificate. I've worked a few years as a leasing agent, and I've done business development for the property management team.
Yeah.
Which was just essentially trying to get new business, new managements into the agency.
Yeah. What made you get into the management side of things? Is that an aspect of real estate you always wanted to get into, or is it something that you just fell into, but you knew real estate was the sort of the passion?
I think ideally I wanted to get into something commission-based and with a bit of sales.
Yeah.
But I decided, because I was already working in leasing and the opportunity came up at that agency for a business development manager, I could step into that position. It actually came about because I was hired, or I had a job offering at another agency in a BDM role, and my principal just created the role for me. He's like, I want you to stay. We'll make you the BDM here.
Yeah, okay.
So he put me into that position.
Nice.
I was kind of thrown into the deep end a little bit.
Yeah.
Not a lot of guidance, but learnt quite a lot. And I guess from there, stayed in kind of the real estate world. I worked for a prop tech company.
How long were you? Sorry, this might have been mentioned. How long were you there leasing, working as a leasing agent, and then also the BDM?
I think the leasing role must have been 2 years or close to it.
Okay.
And then probably around a year in business development.
So 3 years with that same company.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Quite a while. Yeah, it was good. And I think the main reason, honestly, I left was just the lack of guidance and kind of thrown into the deep end a bit.
That's one of the things. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. That's one of the things that I hear a lot with people that we're interviewing for new roles is the reason they're leaving their current job or they're wanting to look elsewhere is the lack of guidance or lack of training. They just get thrown in the deep end.
Yeah, I think it's a big one, because when you're thrown into the deep end, you feel as though, and you're struggling and you've got no one to turn to, then you feel as though you're failing in the role.
Yeah.
So you start looking elsewhere, because you don't want to be a burden on the company. That's why it's so important to have proper guidance and training.
And that was one of the things that you asked us in the interview. What does that training look like? What is that sort of, what's the guidance look like when you come on board? And you've picked it up very, very quickly. So hats off to you. We'll touch on that in a bit more detail down the track as well.
Thank you. No, it's been great starting here. Everyone's been very helpful. And from day one, it's been totally different to any other job I've had.
Great. So, mate. Appreciate that. So you went from 3 years at the same company to then...
3 years. So yeah, 3 years at the same company. Then I moved to Agent Box.
Yeah.
It's a prop tech company.
Yeah.
And I was there for just over 2 years.
Okay.
And that was quite a different role. Obviously it's still real estate kind of oriented, but it was more so a support or like a technical position.
Yeah. What is Agent Box?
Agent Box is a CRM for real estate agents.
Okay.
So it's essentially a database where they store their clients, they store their properties, and they basically from there, almost every agency would have one. So you upload your property in this system, and from there it goes out to real estate domain, all of your kind of third party websites.
Yep.
But yeah, I was essentially just working in like a technical support kind of role.
Okay.
And just really was in need of a change.
Okay. Two years there.
2 years. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what sparked your interest? And then you obviously came to the investors agency from there.
Yes.
What sparked your interest?
Well, I wanted to move in. I was thinking I wanted to get back into kind of a real estate role. I wanted something either sales or kind of a commission-based kind of role.
Yep.
Something that didn't have a fixed income.
Yeah.
And what,
why is that? Because, yeah, I'm not going to say because I don't want to put the words in your mouth.
No.
I'm curious to know, why didn't you want the fixed income that's stable over the long term? What sort of drove you to that commission-based side of things?
I'm young. I'm not in need of stability right now. I'm in need of trading time and working hard to get better results.
Yep.
And if you're on a fixed income, your time does not equate to money at all. It's going to remain the same. Whether you put in 50% effort or 110%, you're going to be reimbursed the same.
Yep.
And that's really what I needed. I needed something where my effort would be appreciated.
Yep.
And then I started looking into kind of buyer's agent roles.
Yeah.
I'd always heard of it. And obviously in Australia, maybe I'm wrong, but in Australia, at least historically, it hasn't been a very, I guess, well-known kind of job.
You're right.
And not really widely used.
Yeah.
But I started looking into it a little bit more. There's virtually nothing on offer. So I was kind of just looking broadly for real estate jobs when I stumbled across your Seek listing quite late at night, right as I'm about to go to bed. I'm like, this looks good. This is in Manly. This is great. Seems like exactly what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So I shot in the application and the rest is history.
I remember speaking to you, giving you a call and then saying, hey, can you come in tomorrow for an interview? I believe it was like, hey, can you come in tomorrow? On the phone, you were very well spoken. I had a good vibe immediately. I was like, when's the earliest you can come in? Call Daz. I'm like, we've got someone coming in, you know, I've got high hopes. And that decision was pretty easy after we met you face to face as well.
That's awesome. It happened so quick as well. Like, I've never been hired anywhere so quickly.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, can you come in tomorrow? Sure. Interview's done. Like waiting. I'm like, after I had the interview, I'm like, okay, now I really want this. I really hope they call.
Yeah.
You guys called. And I'm like,
It was very fast, but I guess we've interviewed over the years hundreds of people.
Wow.
Probably looked at thousands of resumes, like literally thousands of resumes, interviewed hundreds of people. So you after doing it that many times, you know quite quickly who are the ones that stand out and who are the ones that, you know, potentially don't.
Yeah, so you can kind of filter through them.
You can filter through very, very quickly, it was a quick decision because the resume was impressive, your manner was impressive, your experience personally investing in property as well. We'll touch on that.
Yes.
Your experience professionally and personally on the property side, ticked all those boxes, and you've picked it up very, very fast. So hats off to you.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate it. And still learning, but
and you're a you are an entrepreneur at heart.
Let's talk
about it. A lot of people throw that word around.
They do.
It's a word that does get used probably more so than I would have liked. But I mean, you are an entrepreneur at heart.
I'm not going to put it in the Instagram bio just yet. But
why don't you talk a little bit about some of your side hustles that you've done in the past?
We could go for 3 hours on this podcast with all the side hustles I've tried over the years. I've tried it.
Why don't you tell us like about one of the most outrageous side hustles that you tried to do, that whether it failed or it didn't,
and outrageous.
Then one that's succeeded as well.
Okay, sure. So I think probably everyone, if you're into finance and looking to make money online, you've probably looked at drop shipping before. So I've tried drop shipping a million times. Some have failed, some have succeeded.
Yeah.
I was drop shipping moon lamps before. I don't know if anyone's ever seen these. I don't know if you've seen them.
What is a moon lamp?
It's just a lamp that's shaped like a moon. But essentially, they're $5, $10 from China, and you just drop ship them internationally. So that was semi-successful.
Okay. How much, $5, $10 from China, how much are you selling them for?
$70-$80.
Wow.
Yeah. So US as well.
Wow.
So that was okay. I was doing that for a couple of months. I've drop shipped a million different products.
Why did you stop that? Because that sounds like an amazing margin.
The margin was great, but I was doing it all through Google advertising. Okay. And it was kind of the early-ish days of Google advertising. And then there was a turn where they started really upping prices. And obviously when you're in a market that's competitive, if other people are jumping on that same product, you're bidding for, you probably know for any kind of advertising, you're bidding for the views or the clicks. And if someone's outbidding you, then the price can get a little bit out of control,
sure.
which is essentially what happened.
Yeah, okay.
I had a car detailing business I started at one point, which was good. That was not successful at all.
Did you learn anything from the failures? Because that's really important as well. And I feel like not just for those looking to start their own business, but I feel like your failures, like if you have any failures, it can also teach you lots of things just in life and day-to-day life as well.
I think it can. And I have learned a lot from it. The biggest thing I think I've learned is that you can't do everything. And that's what everybody does when they're trying to start a business. You wear every hat.
Yeah.
And it's just not feasible at all. You have to hire people. You have to pay people to do the things that you aren't good at and stick to doing what you are good at, whether that's selling the service, selling the product. If you're not good at marketing, then pay someone to do your marketing.
Yeah.
If you're not good at graphic design, then pay someone to do the graphic design. I think that's what I've learned over the years. And there's so many resources out there now. You can hire people internationally for small-term jobs at a fraction of the cost.
Yeah.
So there's lots of resources out there. I think that's the biggest one I've learned.
That's a really good lesson. I can 100% relate to that. And I was talking to someone like a few weeks ago, I can't remember who it was, but it was in relation to them trying to scale their business. And they were talking about how stressed they were because of the workload that they had and how many hours they were doing. And they were just spread far too thin.
That's right.
And I was saying like what they should be doing. And this is what I did was write down over the course of 1 or 2 months how many hours a day you're spending on different tasks.
Yep.
And then at the end of the month, have a look at what those tasks were, separate them into like the least valuable tasks and then the most valuable task, and then the task that you enjoy doing that you're good at and the task that you don't enjoy doing that you're not good at. And then straight away, you can see if you're spread too thin, well, the least valuable task is admin. Mm-hmm. Just get someone to do your admin. Another task that you might not be good at might be sales. So hire someone that can do sales and then you can do the marketing or vice versa.
That's right.
But it is very hard for those first few years of having your own business. You're wearing, like you said, so many different hats. You get spread so thin. Sometimes you're so in the thick of it, you don't sort of realize, okay, well, I need to step back and break down what the tasks are and employ people to do those tasks.
That's right. Yeah, that's a big one. You've got to learn that. And I think the other one is probably waiting too long to start or working too much at the beginning to get like, oh, I can't start until I have the perfect logo. I can't start until someone's designed my website or until I've designed my website.
Yeah.
Knowing nothing about website design.
Yeah.
Can't start until this is done. I've got to have an Instagram page. I have to have X amount of followers on the page before I start doing this. And I think you just like the best time to start is yesterday. Like you just have to push on with it.
Have you heard of the software Notion?
Yes, actually I have. I've seen get advertisements for it all the time.
Yeah,
I haven't paid for it yet, but it looks good. It's like an AI calendar kind of thing, is it?
Well, it's like an organizer calendar. Yeah. It's got AI integration. It's a pretty powerful tool. And I was watching the interview with the founder or with one of the founder who was also a developer, and they asked him, "What's your biggest regret?" And his biggest regret was not starting far earlier.
Yeah.
It was just sort of sitting there for years and years till he got it out to the level that he thought was the perfect level. And his biggest regret was not getting it out a lot earlier and then improving it as he went. But the counter argument to that is if you put out a product that is not where it should be and then you start getting bad reviews and bad feedback, that can be very detrimental to the business as well.
That's right.
So I think there needs to be a balance.
There has to be a balance.
Without releasing things that it's just going to be detrimental to the business because of feedback, but then also, you know, understanding that it's continuously going to improve over time.
That's right, yeah. There's a fine line. You can't start too early.
Yeah.
You can't start with zero preparation, but you also shouldn't wait 4 or 5 years or 4 or 5 months, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I guess it's very dependent on the business as well.
So you've purchased property before personally as well, right?
Yes, that's right. I am the proud owner of a little one bedroom up in Nelson Bay.
Well done, mate.
Thank
very
you.
Well done. How did that come about?
Well, I've always been very big into property investing, even from high school. I've always had an interest in kind of property investment that just continued to, I guess, gather speed as I moved up in high school and out of high school.
Where do you think that interest came from? I didn't mean to cut you off there, Josh.
No, that's apologies. Fine.
Where do you think that interest came from?
It's hard to say. I think I used to watch a lot of, from a young age, I was always looking for ways to make money, and I was kind of in that kind of space on the internet, watching YouTube videos, different people. And I came across, I think, a couple of people that talking about long-term wealth gain.
Yep.
You see, you have to make money in the short term, but there's ways to create, I guess, generational wealth.
Yeah.
Which for me was always property, which is a big one.
Yep.
I think my dad at one stage did own an investment property as well. At a very young age for me, I guess I didn't really understand the meaning of that back then.
Was it spoken about? What was the conversation like around the table at home? Was there conversation about money, property investing? Do you think there was anything back then that's had an impact on you subconsciously now?
No, nothing I can put my finger on. And I have thought of this before.
Yeah.
Did we ever really have these conversations? No, I don't think we did. I think it all just came down to kind of personal research.
Well done.
Thank you. Yeah. So I always had an interest in it, and I just stumbled into property investing. And that kind of got stuck in my mind where I was looking at properties just out of high school. And once again, a big regret is not buying sooner.
Were you able to buy sooner if you wanted to?
I was, yeah. So there was
what held you back?
What held me back was I had stuck in my head that I should use the first home buyer's grant.
Yeah.
That, you know, you shouldn't buy this first one without using that grant.
Yeah.
You're throwing away money, this and that. And what I didn't know back then that I know now is that it may be better to lose that grant and buy in a place that is going to have a higher capital growth, which we can touch on in a second. But back then I just didn't, that wasn't even in my head. I was kind of thinking, oh, I've got to buy something close by so I can use this grant.
Yeah. That's a really important thing. I feel like that's really good advice or a really good lesson that you've potentially learned now, and something really important that you just mentioned. We had a guest on the show last week, Obi and Andy. Andy was
yes.
on the show, a client of ours.
Yes, been working with Andy and Obi quite closely. They're great.
they're great guys. So Andy came on and he was in the same position where they were looking for property for 3 years and or 2 or 3 years, and they wanted to buy a principal place of residence to benefit from those grants. And I remember telling him when we first had the call with them, before they became a client, saying the exact same thing. If the only way you can get into the market is by using those grants, then take benefit of them and buy whatever property you can.
Yep.
But if you can get in without using those grants, often you can buy assets that will have a stronger return.
That's right.
And like you might be able to, like I bought my first property with the grant. So I was able to buy my first property with a 5% deposit and no stamp duty. So it was about $25,000 for a $500,000 apartment at the time.
Yep.
It was the only way I could get in with my sister. So we did it.
Yeah, sure.
But that property over the course of 10 years only grew at about 4% per annum.
Yeah.
Whereas if we could have bought a property that grew at 10% per annum, we would have made back that stamp duty and any LMI costs in the first year.
That's right.
Compound that over 5-10 years and you're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars difference.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it really comes down to your personal situation. But I think in essence, if you can afford to borrow and you can afford to buy without that, it depends also where you live as well. Because
yeah.
you might live in one of the areas that we're buying in.
Yeah.
And in that case, then buy in your own backyard. That's
yeah.
great. But if you live in Sydney or Melbourne, chances are, first of all, you can't afford a property. And any property that you can afford, you're very much going to be limiting your future serviceability.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I learned. The first kind of properties I was ever looking at seriously when I was at a point where I could buy, I was probably was probably 19 or 20, and I was in a position where I could purchase a property around 300 to 350 grand. And I was looking in Hobart, surrounding suburbs.
Yeah.
And I really wish I bought some of the places I was looking at back then for 300 are now worth 700.
Crazy.
So it's just
crazy. Five, six years ago, Hobart's done more than doubled since then.
Yeah.
That's a good lesson to learn. But regardless, you've got into the market, which is the most important thing.
And yeah.
Did you get into the market on your own, or were you getting help from your parents?
I got into the market on my own. So I didn't use any kind of guarantor or any assistance with the deposit. It was just all money that I had saved up. And while I didn't have direct assistance from my parents, I have to give some credit in that there was a long time where I wasn't paying much rent or any rent at all at home. So that has allowed me to save money.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a lot of people out there that have that same opportunity and don't utilize it.
Yeah, definitely. So how long did it take you? Well done for doing it all on your own. I think that's a really, really good lesson. I mean, it is very, very hard for people in the current climate to be able to save, you know, save enough money to be able to purchase their property, but very sort of evidence that it can be done. How long did it take you to save, and what sort of sacrifices were you making to be able to get into the market?
Yeah, it's hard to say when the real saving started. I mean, I guess we could call it my first full-time job, which was possibly around the age of 17 or 18.
Yep.
I would say from there. And so it took about 4 to 5 years to save up to the point where I purchased my property, although I could have purchased sooner.
Yeah.
So I think it really depends on your kind of situation. Obviously, if you have already left home and you're paying rent, that's greatly, it's going to make it a lot more difficult to purchase. But then at the same time, I purchased by myself.
Yeah.
So if you purchase with another person, once again, that's, you're using two incomes.
Exactly. I really feel one income, depends on the income, but like if you don't have kids and you're living frugally, I'm fairly certain that's the right terminology.
Yeah.
If you're being frugal with your money and you don't have kids and you have average incomes, I really feel you can save one whole income and live off the other whole income.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if you're paying rent and everything. It's just that we live in this society that we are obsessed with consuming, whether it's eating out, whether it's buying, myself included, Black Friday sales, Cyber Monday.
Me too.
It's just, we're just like obsessed, and we see all these ads and we're always wanting to consume. And I guess it's a capitalist society that drives that.
It is.
But I think if you are on two incomes, even if the average incomes, even if you live in Sydney, if you're very cautious with your money, you should really be able to save one whole income and live off the rest.
You can, absolutely. And like you said, we do live in kind of a capitalist society, and it's both a benefit and I guess a detriment as well.
Yeah.
Because it allows us to obviously make huge capital gains if we put ourselves in those positions.
Yeah.
But just as easily you can get caught up in the thick of it and start spending too much. But like you said, I think if you have two incomes to play with, you can definitely live off one. It's just about making sacrifices.
What sort of sacrifices did you make?
So a lot. From 17, 18, when everyone kind of my age, we were all turning 18, obviously people are going out. I was not. I would say no, basically to everything. So looking back on it, sure, I probably missed out on a lot of experiences, but even back then I was always kind of looking into the future.
Yeah.
So I was kind of thinking, okay, when you're in your 30s, 40s, these people are still going to be in the same position.
Yep.
You can get yourself out of it, but it has to start now.
Yeah.
So virtually from 18 to 23, 24, no going out. Very rarely, at least only for birthdays kind of. But everyone my age, friends out every weekend.
Yeah.
So it was a big sacrifice, and it was kind of hard to, and you do lose friendships that way. When people ask you to do things and you say no, people stop asking.
Yeah.
So there was sacrifices made, definitely. Didn't travel as much as I would have liked to.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of it all, it will pay off.
Yeah, well, you made those sacrifices then, so it's sort of like pick your poison. Do you want to pick the easy path now and go down the more difficult path in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s?
Sure.
I shouldn't say 30s. 30s is still very young. I'm halfway through 30s.
Yeah.
But like, do you want to live a really easy life now? And that's fine if you do, but then you need to be willing to accept that if you're taking the easy route now, when you're 40, 50, 60, you're going to be going down. You're going to be working every day. You're going to be struggling.
That's
you're
right.
going to be having to then make sacrifices. And at that stage, it's going to be even harder because everything's going to be more expensive.
That's right. And you're going to have dependents. You'll have children potentially.
Exactly.
And once you have children, it's even harder. You're no longer just fending for yourself.
Yeah.
You have a family to worry about.
Yeah.
And that's going to make it harder. Like if you're finding it to hard to save in your early 20s with no dependents,
yeah,
try saving in your 30s and 40s when you have a family.
Exactly, that's right. And so the other side of it is you make those sacrifices now, and then later on, you know, the idea is that you can live more comfortably.
That's right.
At that stage, I can vouch for when you have kids. I think a mindset shift when you have kids. You also want to be a lot more conservative. So before you have kids, you might be like, oh, I'm happy with X amount of money in my bank account as mm-hmm. a buffer,
yep.
in case there's a rainy day, and that X amount might be 1 month or 2 month worth of expenses mm-hmm. because you just think, well, you know, if I lose my job or if something happens, you know, I'm only supporting myself. So you can make it ends meet very easily.
That's right.
But when you have kids, for us anyway, there was a big light bulb moment that there was like a big shift, a paradigm shift for us where it was like, okay, well, now it's not about acquiring or trying to build wealth or anything like that. It's just about being able to support, like if worst case scenario something was to happen, mm-hmm. how can I now support three people, you know, two kids and my wife, because we're on one household income.
That's right.
So it's like, even if you can then afford to invest at that stage, for a lot of people you have this paradigm shift where you're like, well, now I need to hold on to this money yeah. in case there's a rainy day.
Yep.
So it's a lot harder to do it as you get older and you have those dependents.
It's difficult. Yeah, I think you're less likely to take financial risk, right?
Exactly.
Like you're not going to go and start investing into any new kind of ventures.
Yeah, at least until, you know, you get back onto two incomes and the kids might get out of daycare and then you That's get right. those buffers back up. But yeah, there is this big shift that happens at that stage as well. So the earlier you can get into investing, the better it is. So what did you bought a one bedroom in?
Bought a one bedroom in Nelson Bay.
Yeah. How much?
I guess 520.
Okay.
So it's 520.
What made you pick Nelson Bay?
Nelson Bay I picked because it was within kind of driving distance, barely, but to Sydney. So I could still use the, sorry, we're going to have to cut this because yeah. I'm having a blank on
no,
that.
No, that's fine. What's it called? Well, probably good timing because I was just going down to another point to discuss afterwards anyway.
What's the...
No, so you say Nelson Bay, barely a drive to Sydney. It's a drive to Sydney, but barely.
Yeah, and what's the... Why am I blanking on it? We were just talking about it before. The government incentive...
First-time owner's grant?
Yes.
Okay. Where do you want to start from?
Maybe let's just re-ask the question.
What was my question?
Just about the unit.
Well, why'd you buy in Nelson Bay?
Yeah.
Cool. So why'd you buy in Nelson Bay?
I bought Nelson Bay because it's still within driving distance of Sydney.
Yep.
So I was still able to use that government grant and get that first home buyer's incentive,
yep.
Which was good. But I guess we can talk about that in a minute. But what would I have done differently? We can touch on that in a moment. But my thinking behind Nelson Bay was, yes, I could still use the first home homeowner's grant.
Yep.
And I could still buy close to the water. So yep. it's kind of that old adage of the worst property on the best street.
Yeah.
I bought with waterfront kind of views
nice.
On a cul-de-sac
yeah.
and a place that needed a full renovation, so I was able to add value.
Okay.
And that's one way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
Since working here, I have a little bit different kind of mindset now.
Yeah.
But that was my thinking. I wanted to get something where I could add value and I wanted it to be close to the water.
So, and how much do the renovations cost?
Just under $15,000, and that is because I spent a lot of time going up there.
Yeah.
Every weekend or every couple of weekends, I would go up there, usually on a Friday. I would work from home up there, work all day Saturday, do some quiet things on Sunday,
yeah,
and then drive home Sunday night.
Wow.
So it was a lot of time sacrificed as well. So while the renovations cost, you know, around 14,000 in total, there was, you have to value your time as well.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of a sacrifice.
So what was the finish? How much was the total cost, acquisition and renos, and any other purchase costs that came with it?
It was probably close to 540.
540, yeah.
All things considered.
And then did you get a valuation done afterwards? Have you had one done since?
I had a valuation done very early days, probably only 6 months after I bought it,
yep.
Which came in at 540.
Okay.
I haven't had the reval done yet, but...
And how long ago was that the valuation done?
Valuation was done 6 months after I bought it, so probably August of last year.
Okay.
I believe.
Market's moved since then.
Market's definitely moved since then.
Not across Nelson Bay, but generally national values have increased significantly since
then. Yeah. Nelson Bay hasn't moved as far as I would have liked it.
Yep.
And it's very hard to get an accurate representation there because you have so many holiday homes and a lot of them are one bedrooms. And these one bedrooms might be selling for 300 or 350, but they're different to a unit block that is not a holiday home. These holiday places you can't live in full time.
Right.
You have to rent it out a certain portion of the year.
Yeah.
There's exorbitant amounts of strata fees and different things related,
yep.
Which make them worth a lot less than
definitely
a regular one bedroom unit.
Yeah.
And also it's very hard to get comparable properties because there's something to be said about being so close to the water as well.
Yeah, definitely. That creates a
bit of value. That's right. Yeah. But we do have the unit below mine is going up for auction next weekend. So I'd be very excited to see where that ends up.
Are they accepting offers before auction?
They are.
Okay.
But I think ideally when I spoke to the agent, he said they're kind of hoping to bring it to auction,
yeah,
open to offers beforehand, and we'll see where it ends up. Yeah, I think they're expecting, his expectations were 600 to 650.
Yeah, okay.
So very much hoping to see a six in front of it, but yeah, we'll see how we go.
Well, good luck.
Yeah.
That'll be some good equity for you, depending on what that property sells like. That's a direct comparable.
Yeah,
and then right. That can help you with your deposit for
the next one.
For property number two.
Yes, which I'm hoping for in the second half of next year.
That's
fingers
exciting.
Crossed. We'll see exciting, how we go. Yeah.
What did you learn? What's the biggest lesson that you learned with your first investment?
Biggest lesson I learned, which we touched on earlier, yeah, was to not use that grant,
yeah,
if you can afford to do so.
Yeah.
And I think like a big value of ours here is that we purchase houses,
yeah,
and we have quite a big value on the land that the home is sitting on,
yeah,
not just the asset. When you're buying a unit, there is no land value. You're buying just a unit.
Yeah.
It might be 50, 60 square meters. So it's only the asset that's increasing in value, not the land. I think that's a big lesson. I think if I could have afforded to do so, which I could have looking back on it, I would have purchased a house.
Yeah,
something that was going to see more capital growth over those first few years.
Yeah,
because that's what's going to allow you to get into your second property. You can, you know, some people prefer a cash flowing property, others prefer capital growth. But I think in the beginning, you really want that capital growth.
I agree. Yeah,
just not limit your serviceability.
And you went viral on a TikTok video, didn't you?
Semi.
Let's talk.
I won't say viral.
Let's talk about that TikTok video.
So I just made a TikTok one day. It was actually semi-recently, maybe just a couple of months before I started here. Okay. And it was just talking about my whole experience of purchasing the unit and just kind of had a little time lapse of renovating,
yep,
over the course of that year or just under a year.
Yep.
And it got a lot of attention, had a lot of dislikes and negative comments as well.
What were they?
So I wasn't really overly aware of this, but there's this negative perception of landlords and property investors,
yeah,
and especially those who own multiple properties.
Yeah.
So people calling me a scum lord and this and that.
Yeah.
So quite aggressive. Some of the people like DMing me as well. But just took it in my stride. I think for me personally, there's nothing anyone can say to put a negative perception of property investing in my mind.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, like we said about capitalist society.
Yeah, I have a strong opinion on this, but I'm not gonna verbalize it in such a strong manner.
That's okay. I've got an equally strong opinion on this. I think
I think that we're extremely. I'm gonna preface what I'm gonna say with this first. So sure. I think we're very lucky to be in Australia in a sense that that we have the benefits or have the benefits of assisting those that need it. Like Centrelink and when COVID hit, handing out money and everything else. But then we have the capital aspect, which allows people to benefit for the amount of value that they're providing to society.
That's right.
I think there needs to be a balance. Now, there is a lot of people that complain and think investors are the reason for property prices skyrocketing and so forth. I feel like if those people spend more time focusing on themselves and upskilling their own abilities and providing more value to society, whether it be through their work, whether it be through their skills, they would have a lot more success in that's life. Right. And when I say success, I don't just mean financial. I think that's a very small portion of success. When I say success, I mean they'll be happier. They'll be more accepting of other people. They will be more appreciative of the life they live in. Well, I mean, we live in the best country in the world. Everyone wants to flock here.
I agree.
But when people spend all this time sitting there and abusing, you know, investors, that energy is being spent in the wrong place.
That's right.
And you're sort of a testament to show that you don't need to be on a super high. What income were you on during those 4 or 5 years when you saved the deposit? Or
wow. So my first real estate job, I was in the leasing role. I was on 45K, plus a little bit of commissions. It may be equated to 50K. Before tax.
Wow.
And I was still able to save quite a lot in that position. I think it then moved up to 60.
Yeah.
Kind of coming into that BDM role. And then it moved up to maybe 65 in the next role. And that was for a very short period of time. For the vast majority of that saving, I was on 45K less in those. My first full-time job ever was working for BMW washing cars. My salary was 34.
Wow. Okay. Crazy.
So
so it just shows like it shows you don't have to be. It shows, first of all, a lot of investors are not super high income earners.
No.
You've done this because it's probably not possible to buy, or it's not possible to buy a property in Sydney at that stage for you. So sure. You're looking to set yourself up in other ways. A lot of investors are not super high income earners. A lot of investors are looking to set themselves up so they don't have to rely on the government down the track.
That's right.
So they can support, you know, their family or whatever it might be. It's a shame that, you know, investors do cop a lot of slack. It makes no difference. There's a supply issue in Australia at the moment. Exactly. So whether an investor sells their property or not, it's irrelevant. Sure, someone who is renting might be able to purchase that property. There's still a very large pool of people, of tenants
that can't
because there is far more demand than there is supply. So even if investors sell, some people might be able to buy, but when the government's letting in 500,000 people every year and they're not building the houses to support it, that's exactly where the problem is.
That's right. Yeah, there's always going to be a supply issue, and there's, you know, we know that it, like, we obviously don't need to get too political with it, but we know that a society that shares everything equally for non-equal work doesn't work. So we, you know, it's kind of biting the hand that feeds you a little bit. We live in a country where you're allowed to have the opinions you have, and do the things that you want to do, but then at the same time you're attacking someone for reaping the benefits, I guess, because you're not taking advantage of the benefits of the country you live in.
Yeah, if you've made sacrifices, if you've lost friends because you're not going out, if you're working extremely long hours, you mentioned off the record that you were getting lunch money and not going and eating lunch.
Yeah.
If you're making those sorts of sacrifices, then you should be rewarded according to the sacrifices that you're making.
Absolutely,
And well done for what you've achieved.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience here at the Investors Agency.
Sure.
What's that been like?
It's been great. I've learnt a lot, and obviously, like I said before, one thing I've learnt is, you know, the value of purchasing a property with land as opposed to looking at units and trying to enter the market closer to home.
Yeah.
So I've learnt a lot. I've learnt a lot just in general about how buyer's agents operate, Learned a lot about mortgage broking. It's crazy that we all use the same mortgage broker as well. Shout out to Jeff.
Shout out to Jeff. What a small world, eh?
Yeah, crazy. I've learned so much here. Just about serviceability is a big one that I've kind of learned more about since coming here. It was kind of at a younger age, never stuck in my head that I could limit, because I've always wanted to own all the properties, like give me all the properties, as many as I possibly can.
Yeah.
but it was never kind of stuck in my head that, you know, you can ruin your serviceability and you can limit yourself to two or three and you can get stuck. And that's a big one I've learned here. It's about buying the right property at the right time, depending on your current kind of financial situation. But yeah, it's been great working here. I think I learn something new every day.
Nice.
It's been awesome.
And what are your goals for? I know you said you want to buy your next property in the second half of next year. Any other goals that you want to tick off personally or professionally? Doesn't have to be financially, but yeah, is there any goals that you have personally or professionally that you do want to tick off?
Professionally, I guess personally and professionally, like you said, I want to purchase my second property next year.
Yeah.
And then we'll see how it all goes, but I'd like to purchase a third in the following kind of 1 to 2 years after that. That's kind of my personal investing goal.
Yeah, nice.
Obviously, that ties into your professional life as well.
Yeah.
With our new structure that we're on, I'd like to help out as many clients as I can. And I think it's been really good seeing that so far. Yeah. You can kind of tell that's already a positive, and it is working, kind of having that personal relationship with the client as well.
Yeah.
So that's been awesome. I just want to professionally get better at my job and become more efficient.
Yeah.
And just learn the full process. I've got two trips coming up next year as well.
Nice.
And I'd like to book a third for the beginning of 2025. I'd love to go to Japan.
Yeah, nice.
That's a big one.
What are your trips next year?
Got Bali in February.
Yeah.
And I've got Thailand in May.
Nice.
So about 2 weeks in Bali, just under, and a week in Thailand.
Nice.
So it's going to be nice.
Mate, holidays and having a break is so important. I felt it this year, towards the back end of this year.
It is.
Felt, I've been feeling, hours are not ridiculous, but I've just been feeling quite burnt out, and I just think it's from the lack of break, probably having kids as well.
Yeah.
To some degree. We're out of the thick of it, which is fine. At home, everything's pretty cruisy, pretty chill, which is good, but I'm just quite burnt out and I'm putting it down to no holidays. So next year for me as well, I'm
taking a couple.
Even if we don't go, I will go away up or down the coast maybe, but maybe Bali or something.
Yeah,
but I think Bali's so great. Important, and it really helps productivity when you're back in as well.
Yeah, you have to, like, it's important having a routine, I think, while you're working and kind of in your everyday life, but you have to have a break and get away from it. You need a reset, definitely. And sometimes you can't have a reset just by taking a few days at home.
Yeah.
Because it's still too close to home. You got to get out.
Exactly.
If you can't get out internationally, then like you said, take a drive up the coast.
Yeah.
Definitely need a reset. But the big one is routine. And I think you mentioned that and you've kind of got it stuck in my mind now about having a set routine.
Yeah.
Do you want to mention that? I think you mentioned a few weeks ago that you were struggling, like kind of getting burnt out, but it's always good to have that routine, like gym this time in the morning to this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Do I want to mention my routine?
Yeah.
Interviews turned.
Well, I'm curious.
My routine.
Maybe it can help me.
Yeah. I'm pretty big on routines.
Yeah.
I feel like there's this big push, especially on social media at the moment, of these, they're generally males and they're generally like obsessed with like being super productive every second of the day and never slowing down and trying to take over the world. So I'm going to preface what I'm about to say with, I'm not in that category. I have no interest in that. And I'm the older I'm getting, the more I'm moving away from that. But I do wake up at 4 a.m. Every day.
Wow.
I've got a pretty good routine. And the routine, it's not for me to get stuck straight into work. I'll wake up at 4 a.m., go get a coffee, believe it or not. There's a cafe that's open at 4 a.m.
Oh, really?
Yeah, go get a coffee.
Which cafe is that?
I think Taste Espresso in Colleroy.
Wow.
They do really good coffee. There's quite a few people there at that time as well. Get my coffee, go to the gym, but the gym doesn't start till 5, so just sit there outside the gym in the car for about 45 minutes. I'm journaling and reading.
Yeah, that's good.
And I'm not reading books on like business or anything, or finance or anything like that.
No.
Reading books on like men, like at the moment I'm reading The Daily Stoic. It's just one page, very, very easy, simple read, but then I journal after I've read that. Okay. And it's just like a...
So you still prefer like non-fiction kind of?
Definitely still non-fiction.
Yeah.
So that's more of a philosophical kind of book. Just puts me in a good headspace, helps me be more present, more mindful. Go to the gym at 5, then finish at 6, head back home, have a dip in the ocean. And then by the time I get home, that's when the family's up.
Every morning?
Cold shower after the ocean. Wow. And then by the time I have the cold shower, family's up. I leave my phone. I don't have my phone with me when I'm with my family in the morning.
That's good.
Not checking emails, not checking my phone, not doing anything. So that first, even though I'm up at 4 a.m., that first 4 hours is nothing to do with like business, finance or anything. It's like personal, like helping myself mentally, personally, good. Family time. And then I get stuck into it when I come in.
See, I knew I could learn a thing or two from your routine. Mine is nowhere near as crazy as that. Well, I am in a routine now.
What's yours, mate?
My routine is I wake up at 5:45. Yep. It's not quite 4 a.m.
That's all right.
I give myself about 15 minutes just...
I wasn't waking up at 5:45 at your age. I'll put it that... Okay. At your age, I was not getting up. I did not have this 11. Routine at that age. I was gymming in the afternoon and so completely different as I've gotten older. So you're doing very well getting up at your age at 5:45.
Yeah, so 5:45 most mornings, okay. Maybe 6:15 if I really want to sleep in a little bit. I'll get up, have a coffee, and then I've been lately reading for half an hour.
Yeah.
And then I go from reading straight to the gym.
Nice. What are you reading?
Right now, people are saying this book is a red flag, so... I don't know. I didn't know anything about this before I started reading it, and I've only just kind of started. But the book's called 48 Laws of Power. I don't know if you've read that.
No, I haven't read it.
Maybe you have to add it to your next. apparently, it's a red flag when people see that people are reading that.
Okay.
I didn't know this. Okay. I only found out through Instagram Reels, which is not a good source of information, after I started reading it. But it's quite interesting so far.
Yeah, okay.
I'll read for half an hour and then I'll head to the gym for an hour, come back, have a shower, straight to work.
Nice, mate.
It's okay.
That's a good routine.
Well, it's not quite as good as yours. And there's too much phone involved in that time. I think I need to cut that out as well.
And each to their own. Like the phone and social media for me is Social media has a big negative impact on my mental health and mental space. My phone has a big negative impact on me being present with my family.
Yeah.
So it depends. Like if it doesn't impact you. Like
it definitely does impact me. Well, I just let it for some reason and yeah, I shouldn't. Yeah. It's bad. And I think like it's actually not being spoken about enough how addictive it is, and it kind of ruins your brain. Like the dopamine hit you get just from scrolling through those reels.
Yeah.
And like I challenge anyone the next time you're in kind of one of those reel scrolling events to try and remember the last 5 or the last 3 that you watched, because I guarantee you can't.
Yeah.
Even if you've got that stuck in your head, you won't remember. And I think it's,
there's this
insanely negative.
Yeah, there's this book, Dopamine Nation. Anna, I can't remember her last name, Anna someone, but if you type in Dopamine Nation, it'll come up and talks about this.
I haven't read that.
And it talks about the impacts of social media, but also the impacts of any other source of dopamine that we're obsessively trying to find, even subconsciously.
Yeah.
Like we don't even realize that we're chasing that dopamine hit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
And then the impact that it has on you.
I've heard of people doing kind of dopamine resets where they just won't go on their phone, not on a computer if they can avoid it, aside from work, but no social media and just only reading in their spare time or getting outdoors.
Yeah.
Gym, obviously things like that are fine.
Yeah.
But just having a full reset where they don't use social media.
Yeah.
Apparently it's quite beneficial. I haven't yet to try it.
I think it's so important. I would really struggle to do it for a long period. I want to try to do it. We're going away on the 15th, campervanning, just going up north. I'm already using the wrong language. I was going to say, I will try my best to do it.
I will.
Not with that language, I'm not going to do it. I will go off social media for that period. I'd love to just have like, 8 or 9 days where I'm campervanning with the family and have nothing on my phone.
I think I might do the same.
It is really important. But I think as you get older, if you're already thinking about those sorts of things at your age, I think as you get older, you'll start implementing different things. Like for me, with my routine, it became more and more thorough as I had kids.
Yeah.
And as work became more stressful, there's things you have to do so you can deal with other aspects of your life. As you get older, there's going to be more and more stresses that you have to deal with. And if you don't implement things on the other side to deal with them,
going to crack under the pressure.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right. So, mate, it's been, I want to be respectful of your time. I know you guys are under the pump with this last, this is going to get released in the new year, but recording it on the last week of work in
2023.
So, mate, thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything That's else all. That you wanted to, final words of wisdom you wanted to share with the listeners?
Wow, final words of wisdom. Don't buy one better in Nelson. No. No. Look, final words of wisdom, I think try and learn from other people's mistakes. Save all your money. Don't go out. Say no to people, but don't lose friends. And buy your first investment. Do it in your 20s if you can. And if you're in your 30s or 40s, then the only time to start is now.
Mate, well, hats off to you. You've been able, you show that it's possible even on an average income at a very young age. So well done, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you, mate.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening to the Lazy Equity Podcast. The advice given on this podcast is of a general nature only, and you should make your own decisions before taking any financial risks. If you would like to stay in touch with the show, join the Lazy Equity Facebook group, or find the Investors Agency on Instagram and Facebook.